We are live here at the studios. Mike McCormick here with Maria Tomchick. Maria?
Hi, Mike.
Good to have you back.
It is really nice to be back.
We are we are hoping to get Job back for next week, but we wanted to...
We will have to work out how to remote him in while I'm here live, and that's a little trickier than it sounds.
Yeah, we're not actually sure yet if that's...
If it'll be live or if we'll pre-record and then air it immediately after.
Or soon thereafter.
Yeah.
The pressure. Mm-hmm. But it is good
but we're
to
working
be
on
back.
It.
We are, and we appreciate everybody's patience because I know that's been a long time. Without us.
Yeah, I this week made the risk calculation in my mind that I could actually manage two bus rides and a light rail line ride to get here and be in the studio with Mike. I made that risk calculation and I thought that I could do it. So whereas before I didn't think I was able to with given my time schedule. I've been doing work as an IT support person for an office full of 42 people, the vast majority of whom are working from home. So that means on the IT side, a lot of work. And I mean a lot of work. So that things are kind of starting to stabilize for us. So
very good. And we're going to reap the benefits of that starting right now. So let's... A million things have been happening both this week and since we have all been on the air. Big change this week with the King County Labor Council.
Oh, yeah. The Seattle Police Officers Guild was voted off of the King County Labor Council. Excuse me. On Wednesday, a 55.3% majority of the delegates to the King County Labor Council voted to kick the Seattle Police Officers Guild off the council entirely. This came as a surprise to a lot of folks, although the Labor Council's full name, I'll just remind people, is the Martin Luther King County Labor Council. So it would have looked pretty bad if they had not tried to at least hold SPOGS, the Seattle Police Officer Guild's feet to the fire. This vote came about 2 weeks after an earlier vote by the council to pass a resolution calling on SPOG to meet with the council and demonstrate that it was working to address racism within its own ranks. To talk about racism in the police community nationwide, and to pledge to negotiate a new contract with the city that doesn't seek to avoid court-mandated reforms, as SPOG has done in the past, particularly the reforms surrounding police accountability. The council gave SPOG until June 17th to reply to their request. The Labor Council, in the past, has provided quite a bit of support for prior SPOG contracts, including the most recent one, may put heavy pressure, the King County Labor Council, on the City Council to approve that contract, which the City Council did by an 8-1 vote, with only Shama Sawant voting no. So this is a 180-degree change for the Labor Council. And it's worth asking how that came about. Delegates from unions with very diverse membership have pushed for the council to take this vote. Including healthcare workers and service employees. In addition, a petition was circulated by Black, Indigenous, and People of Color union members demanding that SPOG be removed from the King County Labor Council. And leaders of the Black and Latino communities here in the city of and Indigenous communities here in the city of Seattle also sent a letter to the King County Labor Council demanding that SPOG be held accountable. There were several conservative unions, on the other hand, like the building trades, the firefighters, and the electrical workers who voted against kicking SPOG off the council, but they were outvoted. An open letter that SPOG President Mike Solon sent to the council didn't acknowledge any issues with racism within the police department. This was a letter he sent in response to their vote 2 weeks ago. The letter instead took a whining tone, exposing a pretty deep vein of white fragility within the Seattle Police Department. I'm just going to quote from that. A quote is, "We have felt misunderstood, spurned, betrayed, and our working conditions have significantly deteriorated. But we continue to come to work every day to serve even those who reject us and insult us," end quote. Essentially, as I said, exposing how deeply fragile the culture is in the Seattle Police Department, that when faced with even legitimate, really legitimate criticism of racism within their institution, the best they can come up with, we feel hurt that you're criticizing us. It's worth noting that in the last SPOG presidential race, Solon was the conservative backlash candidate who pushed out Kevin Stuckey, a black officer who'd headed the union since 2016. SPOG itself has only been a member of the King County Labor Council since 2014, and Stuckey had maintained a pretty close relationship to the council, but Solon, not so much. In addition to Solon's defiant letter, many council delegates were offended by his refusal to discuss the violent tactics used against protesters in recent weeks, including members of the Healthcare Workers Union who've been providing care to injured protesters injured by the police, and in the process have found themselves targeted by police. And I'm talking about tents that were obviously marked as medical stations who were targeted with tear gas from Seattle police on the street. And it's worth remembering that, too. I'm just going to point out to people that on a real battlefield in a war, targeting medical facilities is considered a war crime. So I think we can look at it as a crime by officers on the street when they target medical personnel, people who wear clearly identifiable clothing and who are in clearly identifiable medical care stations giving assistance to protesters. That's a crime, okay? And that was not addressed by Solon either. Notably, Solon sent an open letter to Mayor Durkin on June 6th, arguing for the necessity of using tear gas and other chemical weapons against peaceful protesters at the East Precinct demonstration on Capitol Hill, claiming that protesters had thrown objects which, quote-unquote, which have exploded. And he didn't specify what those objects were. And in response to questions by local journalists, the police department only provided one video showing one protester throwing what looked like the stub of a memorial candle. Other protest videos have shown some protesters throwing half-empty plastic water bottles, which, even if they explode, cannot be seriously considered weapons. So when the vote came up this Wednesday, representatives from over 150 union locals voted to expel SPOG. That was a total of 45,435 delegates. So we're talking about a lot of unions and a lot of people here. Black Lives Matter, Seattle King County immediately supported that decision. BLMSKC has also asked Mayor Durkin for a seat at the table when SPOG negotiates its new contract. And Durkin has put the negotiations on pause while she considers how to include community members in the negotiations. We'll see what the outcome of that thought process is.
Yeah, especially considering she often uses the term community members to mean businesses.
Yes, to hand-picked businesses that support her thought process and her positions. Excuse me. Meanwhile, a week ago or so, City Attorney Pete Holmes had withdrawn the city's request that Superior Court Judge James Robart end the Department of Justice consent decree and court oversight of the Seattle Police Department. That whole process, just to remind people, the whole process of the consent decree and court oversight began back in 2012. So it's been going on a while now, 8 years, and has recently been held up by SPOG's refusal to include certain court-mandated reforms and reforms that have been passed into law by the city council in their recent contract. Those reforms center around police accountability and what resources victims of excessive force and biased policing and their families have when an officer brutalizes or murders a suspect. That's a very serious issue. And Judge James Robart has agreed that it's a sticking point in releasing the city from the consent decree. And of course, SPOG has refused to address it. Now, some folks are going to claim that, you know, with this whole vote by the King County Labor Council, that sets a bad precedent, that unions must stick together, that workers have the right to control their working conditions, et cetera. But I just want to say there are limits to that. And the limit is really clear. You can't bargain for the right to commit a crime and get away with it, period. I don't care who you are. That would mean that you're no longer a union. Instead, you're a criminal gang, essentially. That is the difference. A police union can bargain for salaries, they can bargain for working conditions, but it can't bargain for the ability of its members to murder people of color on the street, to use dangerous tactics that are not approved and not best practices, and then to avoid any oversight or punishment for those actions. That's unacceptable, period. And the King County Labor Council, they understood that, the majority of the unions, I should say, understood that, and they stood for that this week, and I want to congratulate them.
All right. All right, anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. Also, City Council has been busy this last week.
Yes, the City Council has been busy passing a suite of police reform bills this week, all of which were proposed by Shama Sawant. Monday, the council passed three bills that put restrictions on the Seattle Police Department. First, the ban on the use of chokeholds. I want to point out here that there are two types of chokeholds. People who haven't studied martial arts like I have don't know this, but there are considered to be two different types of chokeholds. One is a bar arm or airway chokehold, which is notorious for a high fatality rate because it can easily crush the windpipe or the esophagus. And then you can't bring the person back once that's done. That's considered in martial arts a kill move when you crush a person's esophagus or windpipe. And the second type is the carotid chokehold, which restricts blood flow to the brain. It's often considered safer, but that's misleading when people say it's safer than a bar arm chokehold, because a carotid chokehold is very dangerous. It can damage major arteries in the neck, and it can cause a stroke. In addition, any pressure on the neck, any pressure whatsoever, can damage the bones and soft tissue in the neck, not just the arteries, not just the windpipe. Bar arm chokeholds have been banned for decades in many major police departments and correctional facilities nationwide, but that hasn't stopped them from being used by personnel in police departments. For example, Eric Garner, if you look at the videos, I know a lot of people have looked at those and probably don't want to look at it again, but Eric Garner was killed with what I believe was a bar arm chokehold, for example. Now, also, in the recent death of George Floyd, again, if you look at the video, Officer Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for almost a full 9 minutes. That would be considered a chokehold. Anything that puts pressure on the neck like that is potentially fatal. And when you do it for a long period of time, you're essentially committing murder. This ban passed by the Seattle City Council covers both types of chokeholds. It defines them well. And it says, quote, officers of the Seattle Police Department are prohibited from using chokeholds in the discharge of their duties, including neck restraints or carotid restraints. So it does not make a difference between the two main types of chokeholds. And it does not leave a loophole for neck restraints, which are sometimes still used by police departments and in correctional facilities. And it also gives victims and their families a right to sue the city if officers violate the ban. So it really puts the pressure where it belongs, which is on the city and on the leadership of the Seattle Police Department to provide adequate training to their officers and remind them that you can't put pressure on a suspect's neck. You can't do that. Even if you have to put pressure on other parts of the body, you know, you can do that, but you cannot restrict air or blood flow to the brain. Now, the second bill referred to a problem that occurred during the recent protests. Police who attacked protesters had covered their badge numbers to avoid repercussions. Now, we know that police in full riot gear, including helmets and face shields, are indistinguishable one from the other. And the only way you can identify them is individually is from their badge numbers and their name tags, which they are required to wear. They are required to wear name tags under a law passed in 2000 in the wake of police riots during the WTO protests. And I remember that. Mm-hmm. Mayor Durkin said that the SPD had told her this week, or perhaps it was late last week, that officers had covered their badges, quote, in mourning for a fallen officer. But that was obviously a lie. As many of those same officers had also obscured or removed their name tags or worn name tags that had their name printed in very tiny font. This bill states that officers may wear a mourning badge, may wear a mourning band on their badges, but only if it doesn't cover the badge number. And it requires officers to wear name tags with large print. It specifies 24-point font, and to provide their names whenever they are asked for them. The exception, of course, is undercover police officers. So that was the second bill that was passed.
And that addresses an issue that we saw repeated in much of the video that was shot during the last couple of weeks, of where people would ask officer for their name, and basically they were blown off.
Yeah, get no response at all. So this bill is meant to address that as well. Now, the third bill banned the Seattle Police Department from purchasing, storing, and using crowd control weapons for purposes of crowd dispersal. It also bans other police agencies from using the same types of crowd control weapons inside the city of Seattle for the same purpose. And the ban is pretty comprehensive. It bans, and this is a direct quote from the legislation, kinetic impact projectiles, chemical irritants, acoustic weapons, directed energy weapons, water cannons, disorientation devices, ultrasonic cannons, or any other device that is designed to be used on multiple individuals for crowd control and is designed to cause pain or discomfort. That was a direct quote from the legislation. There was one exception, pepper spray. Pepper spray can be used only to subdue a suspect engaged in a criminal act or who's a danger to others, and only if the pepper spray won't fall on other bystanders or other people. But it can't be used to disperse a crowd. That was the one exception in the bill. Some officers have complained that, oh, well, the nature of pepper spray is that it disperses, so it's going to fall on other people, which means pepper spray is also banned under this bill. I don't believe that to be true. But I do believe that officers have to consider carefully before they use any pepper spray on any suspect what the ramifications are. And I think that's a good thing. Now, this ban also, like the earlier bills, also gives victims the right to sue the city if police violate the ban. So, for example, if police use flashbang grenades in the next large demonstration, then a large number of people could potentially sue the city for that. That's a pretty good deterrent. At least now, I want to talk about an aspect of this bill that has been widely debated in the activist community here in Seattle. And it was the actions of Lisa Herbold around this bill. Again, the bill was presented by Shama Sawant. Lisa Herbold sought to delay the bill for a week, and she sought to add an amendment to the bill that was widely condemned by a lot of people on the left. And I want to talk about that a little bit. Excuse me. Lisa Herbold wanted the Community Police Commission, the Office of Police Accountability, and the Office of the Inspector General for Public Safety, those are the three bodies set up by the police reform process here in Seattle, to have a chance to look at this legislation, review it, and to issue their opinions on it to the City Council before the City Council voted to whether they should pass or not pass the bill. That's why she asked for that 1 week delay. She's the chair of the Public Safety Committee. She appeared to be trying to get the three oversight bodies specifically set up under the police reform process to do their jobs according to the police reform process, to give advice to the City Council that the City Council could then act on. That's especially true given that the Community Police Commission's only power, the only fully civilian oversight body for the Seattle Police Department's only power, is to make recommendations in these types of situations. Okay? So I have to say I side with Herbold on that, and that I think Shama Sawant was wrong, and the folks who support Sawant and say Herbold was trying to drag her feet or slow the process, they're wrong as well. If we're going to have a police reform process, if we're going to try to hold SPOG accountable and hold the Seattle Police Department accountable, we have to follow the law. And we have to allow the oversight bodies to do their job. And I think Lisa was right in that. I should point out that by Monday, too, you know, some people will say, well, you know, the SPD needed to be stopped ASAP. And that was Shama Sawant's argument. But I have to say that by Monday, when the Seattle City Council took their vote, that the police had already stopped gassing demonstrators because Judge Richard Jones had issued his temporary restraining order against the use of crowd control weapons. That was a 2-week restraining order. That's why the police stopped tear gassing and using flashbang grenades, is because that temporary restraining order was in place. So there was time. A week would have been just fine in that situation. And then 2 days later, on Wednesday, Judge Jones turned that restraining order into a preliminary injunction that's set to last until September 30th. So whether the city council had passed the bill or not passed the bill, the ban would still be in place at least until September 30th. So the council could have very easily waited a week to hear from the Community Police Commission and the other two bodies. Likewise, an amendment that Herbold proposed to allow police to use these weapons to subdue individual suspects committing a crime was also condemned by Sawant. But this same language was language that had been originally proposed by the Community Police Commission in 2015 and early 2020. Herbold didn't come up with this stuff just out of thin air because she wanted to slow or water down the bill. She was proposing language that was language proposed by the Community Police Commission. They had recommended banning these weapons for crowd control, but not to subdue dangerous suspects. In fact, the CPC has never looked at banning these weapons entirely. Herbold was merely trying to give the CPC the opportunity to formally make that recommendation to fully ban these. So if you look at it from that perspective and with that background in place, Herbold was not trying to water down the bill. She was not trying to delay it in the hopes of defeating it. She was trying to follow legally the process in place for reform. And that would have, I think, meant that the city council, if they had followed Herbold's recommendations, would be less likely to sustain criticism from the right and from supporters of the Seattle Police Department and of SPOG, who are now saying, well, the city council acted brashly and hurriedly, and they didn't fully consider this, and they're not following the police reform process, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we need to look at it in that perspective, in that light as well.
And one would imagine that if those three organizations had weighed in and been supportive of the work, that had it been legally challenged later, that would
give cover for the city council.
Yeah.
Who, if and I imagine this ban is going to be legally challenged. I can't imagine that the Seattle Police Department would just let it go. They've sued for lesser issues with the city council, so it is going to be challenged legally. And I think it would have been a big bonus to have a formal recommendation from at least the Community Police Commission to ban these weapons outright. They may recommend it still, but it would have been great to have it before the city council acted on it. Now, also I want to mention, too, that later in the week, Tammy Morales announced that she is working on a bill to ban police involvement in the navigation team, whose original mission was to connect homeless people to housing and services. And I have to say it's about time that the city council considers that. Given that Mayor Durkin has thrown out the service aspect of the navigation team and turned it into a harassment squad that pushes homeless people around the city, confiscates and throws away their belongings, and generally just treats them like trash. It's time, past time, really, for the city council to consider mandating that the navigation team be for service provision, providing service only, and that if police have to be called in a dangerous situation, that there be mental health folks on site, that there be service providers on site having tried to provide services first, and that it be an actual dangerous situation, not merely have police on site to just push people along.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's talk about the budget negotiations at the city council.
Okay. And,
in the wake of the police riot, the city council announced that they will do a deep dive into the Seattle Police Department's budget. Anti-racism protesters are calling for the council to defund the police budget by 50% and direct that money to cover services for underfunded communities of color, including providing housing services, affordable housing, healthcare, mental health services, jobs programs, among many other things that food programs, among many other things that the city could do with that money. The Seattle Police Department has, at least as long as I've been looking at the budget, some 25, 30 years, the police department has taken an ever-growing share of the city's budget. And it is time to look at all the things that we ask the Seattle Police Department to do that could be better done by providing services instead of simply punishing people for being poor and in need, or having a mental health condition or a drug addiction. Now, because of the pandemic, there and with many businesses closed and people laid off, the city is also looking at a shortfall of some $200 to $300 million in tax revenue just this year, primarily because sales tax is down, because people are not out, you know, spending money like they typically do, and B&O tax revenue is down because so many businesses have closed and don't have revenue coming in the door to pay tax on. Up to $500 million is the budget hole over the next two-year budget process, is the calculation. And that's even as the cost of dealing with the pandemic continues to grow, the need for the city to put money into things like testing and healthcare services, food programs in particular for people who are out of work and unable to buy groceries too. Now, this week, two city council members announced potential ways to raise for the city to raise more revenue. First, Teresa Mosqueda announced her own business tax proposal, an alternative. You can't help but see it as an alternative to Shama Sawant's and Tammy Morales's $500 million per year tax Amazon proposal. Mosqueda's tax, called Jumpstart Seattle, would impose a tax on businesses with payrolls over $7 million. Those businesses would have to pay a 0.7% tax on any salaries that fall between $150,000 and $499,999. For salaries of $500,000 and higher, those businesses would pay a higher executive tax of 1.4%. For businesses with payrolls over $1 billion, the two rates are different. They're higher. It's 1.4% and 2.1%. And that's led a lot of people to say, oh, this is just another tax Amazon proposal, because who else in the city of Seattle has payrolls over $1 billion? And I would have to say, well, I don't even know that Amazon has that kind of payroll here within if you're looking only at workers here within the city of Seattle. I think Mosqueda just kind of took those numbers out of the air. She doesn't really know herself. Now, some businesses are exempt. Grocery stores, which don't pay huge salaries anyway, except maybe to their top executives. Insurance businesses and agents, motor vehicle fuel merchants and distributors, liquor stores and government agencies. Most of those are exempt by law in the state of Washington anyway from these kinds of taxes. So that had to be written into the bill. Now, the tax would start in January and would sunset on December 31st, 2030. So it's really just for the next decade is how long the tax would run. Mosqueda is proposing that in the 18 months that it takes to collect the first round of taxes, that the city spend down its rainy day funds, then replenish those funds with the new tax revenues. The rainy day funds would be, initially, the rainy day funds would be spent on homelessness services, affordable housing, small business support, immigrants and refugees, and food programs, all made more necessary because of the pandemic. So predominantly programs that are required now because of the pandemic and the deep recession that our economy is in. After the year 2022, the funds would go for affordable housing construction, equitable development initiatives. Those are community development initiatives in primarily communities of color, and support for local businesses and tourism. That's the smallest chunk of the funding. Now, Mosqueda has shopped her proposal around to a number of businesses, so she's already got buy-in from the more liberal wing of the business community here in Seattle. For example, companies like Expedia and Ethan Stoll Restaurants, who support this bill and not the tax Amazon proposal. Although the Seattle Chamber of Commerce has already weighed in and said that they're against any new tax right now during the recession. Notably, Mosqueda's tax proposal would raise less than half of Sawant and Morales' tax Amazon proposal. And as a point of comparison, the tax Amazon proposal would only tax the top 2% of Seattle businesses based on their total payroll at a flat rate of 1.3%. Small businesses, nonprofits, co-ops, grocery stores, schools, and government agencies would be exempt. The tax Amazon proposal introduced by Shama Sawant and supported by Tammy Morales, that bill was put on hold back in March when Governor Inslee barred the state government and municipalities from passing any legislation except to address emergencies or the pandemic. Instead, Sawant's supporters are now gathering signatures on an initiative to the voters. They'll need to somehow, in the middle of a pandemic, gather 21,000 signatures in person in time to qualify for the November ballot because online signatures have not been approved by the state. They have until mid-September to meet that goal, so it's not clear that they will be successful in that, but they are out there trying to do that.
I'll see if I can find the numbers. I saw numbers earlier this week that made it look like it was steaming along.
So they're working hard on that. Andrew Lewis is the other council member this week who talked about a new proposal to raise revenue. He represents District 7. That's my district. He proposed that the city council pass a capital gains tax on the sale of assets like stocks and bonds in order to fund affordable housing. He said it would impact less than a third of Seattle residents, and real estate and retirement accounts would be exempt from the tax. Other assets would be taxed at 1%. Now, capital gains tax, just to remind people, you pay the tax when you sell any kind of asset, like stocks or bonds, and you pay it not on the full proceeds of that sale, but on the profit that you make. So the proceeds less what you initially paid for it. And, you know, there may be some other expenses you can include to reduce your capital gain rate, too. But generally, it's that difference between what you get for it when you sell it versus minus what you paid for it initially. That's your capital gain or your capital loss. If you had a loss, you wouldn't pay anything in taxes. If you had a gain, you would pay 1% of the gain in tax to the city of Seattle. And of course, real estate is not included. He said that that's exempt. And retirement accounts, if you have an IRA, if you have a pension plan, if you have a 401k, any gain in that would be exempt as well. Now, a capital gains tax has been discussed at the state level, and that's why it has never been proposed here in the city of Seattle before. But during this last legislative session, it didn't even get a vote out of committee to the floor of either chamber. In 2017, the council, just as a reminder to folks, in 2017, the council passed a 2.25% wealth tax on households that make more than $250,000 per year for singles and $500,000 per year for couples. That tax was defeated in the state appeals court last year. And the state Supreme Court, I think it was in April of this year, they ruled that they would not hear that case. They threw it back to the appeals court decision. So that tax is dead for all intents and purposes. So Andrew Lewis has proposed this capital gains tax since that wealth tax is pretty much done. Lewis is also shopping around his proposal to the liberal business community even as we speak. So there may be some changes made to weaken it. I think one potential change that businesses will probably propose is a sunset clause, just like the one included in Mosqueda's proposal that would end the tax in 10 years. I think that's one that Lewis is going to have to contend with, because that's what businesses are going to demand. You can do a capital gains tax, but it has to sunset. Interestingly, this tax, Lewis says, this tax does not compete with the tax Amazon proposal or Mosqueda's proposal because it's not a tax on businesses. It's a tax on individuals, on households. So it's interesting that businesses are already weighing in on that tax. And I think that's because their executives are the ones who will have to, the owners of businesses here in the city of Seattle are the ones who would pay the most under that tax. So that's something we'll have to see how that develops as the weeks roll along here.
So do you think that real estate should be exempt from that pursuit?
No. If you ask me specifically, I think only a person's primary residence should be exempt from that tax. I think if you own vacation rental, if you own properties, if you flip homes to as your business, if you if you're in the process of using second, third, fourth homes that you have bought as a personal investment, I think you should pay the tax. That's my personal opinion as somebody who prepares tax returns and sees how the system can be unequal. I think that real estate should also be included.
Because real estate is where the bulk of the wealth on this planet is right now.
It's a hot market. Yeah. And given that the Trump tax law, that tax reform, quote unquote, reform bill highly benefited real estate developers, I think we should be looking at a tax on real estate developers. Now, the city doesn't want to do that because real estate developers will immediately turn around and say, oh, you'll never get affordable housing if you tax us. That's crap. I just want to say that. That's crap. Because the bulk of real estate development in the city has been luxury properties and commercial real estate, and the city should be taxing that.
Yeah.
Because the federal government's not taxing it in the way that it should be.
Well, it certainly appears that real estate developers have been getting their way in this city
for
a long time.
Oh, yes. And I think we all saw headlines during the pandemic here that when they were told to shut down, when real estate businesses were told to shut down, only build things if it's an emergency, they didn't heed that. They just went on full steam ahead. And I think that's something we need to remember, too, that the real estate industry tends to feel that they're exempt from most laws in that regard, and that they barely adhere, sometimes some companies barely adhere to OSHA standards. As many construction workers will tell you, they've been on a lot of job sites that are not safe.
I've walked by some in my neighborhood.
yes. I think the city's passing up, city council members are passing up potentially ripe fruit there when they exempt real estate.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on the city budgets?
Nope.
Okay. You want to move on then to state budget?
State budgets, yeah. If the city budget is looking at potentially $500 million shortfall in the 2-year period, the state budget's having an even worse time. This week, the state announced that revenue projections put the pandemic-sized hole in the state budget another $4.5 billion deeper. That makes it a total of about $9 billion, I think. A $9 billion chunk missing from the state budget because the state hasn't been able to collect enough sales tax and enough B&O tax to support the state budget that was just passed in the legislature this spring.
Gosh, $9 billion, it's weird because I'm pretty sure we gave away about $9 billion to the Lazy Bee alone. So,
closing.
Only Inslee hadn't forced us to do that.
Yeah, now Governor Inslee this week also, and I want to point out too that the state government isn't just running in the red. Governor Inslee has also canceled a 3% wage increase for upper management personnel in the state government. Fortunately, because he's a Democrat, he said, you know, executives and in the state can deal with not getting a pay increase this year, but that other personnel, lower level state personnel, will continue to get their wage increase. But he also announced that 40,000, on the other hand, he also announced that 40,000 state employees will take one furlough day per week without pay between June 28th and July 25th. So even as people's hourly wage may go up, their overall income could go down if you're a state employee. And then after July 25th, many state employees will have to take one furlough day per month without pay, at least through the fall. That was his announcement. This comes after Governor Inslee vetoed $235 million in new spending that was included in this year's legislative session when the pandemic hit. Now, state legislators have been working on their own to revise the state budget to try to find extra funds to address COVID-19 and to fill in that huge shortfall in tax revenue. The state has only about $3 billion in the reserve accounts, like the rainy day fund. That's not enough to fill the entire hole. The State Office of Financial Management is also trying to identify about 15% cuts in various departments to help with that effort. And that's a big cut for a lot of the state's departments. But some Democrats are talking about new taxes for the first time in years. But I have to point out that if a new tax is passed, any new tax, even a capital gains tax, which couldn't pass when the state was prosperous last year. Can a new tax pass during the worst recession that we've seen in our lifetimes? That's an open question, given the pushback that we're going to get from businesses who say, hey, you know, I can't pay my workers, much less pay a new tax. Now, Frank Chop, the former House Speaker and considered a conservative Democrat, has announced a proposal to raise $2 billion through a combination of a state capital gains tax and a corporate payroll tax, essentially combining elements of what I just talked about, the tax Amazon proposal, more likely look like Mosqueda's Jumpstart Seattle tax, and Andrew Lewis's proposal to tax capital gains. Now, the state payroll tax that CHOP has proposed would be levied on companies that pay employees more than $500,000 each. The tax would be 5%. That's a significantly larger chunk than the city is talking about. For compensation of over $10 million per person, that would really be executive salaries, the company would pay a 10% tax. That's a significant chunk. This would raise, in CHOP's estimation, about $500 million per year. The capital gains tax, which I haven't seen details of yet, he estimates would raise an additional $500 million per year. Now, on the Senate side, State Senator Joe Nguyen from Seattle, he favors a payroll tax on companies that pay individual employees more than $1 million each. So he would change it to up that initial limit, you know, floor for the tax at $1 million per person. So any salaries over $1 million, then businesses would have to pay the tax. Now, Senator Liz Lovelett is coming at it from another direction. She is proposing a bill to increase the estate tax on estates with more than $3 million while lowering the tax on smaller estates. She's also interested in taxing inheritances, something that the federal government doesn't do. It's something that would also impact wealthier and predominantly white residents of Washington state, because one of the problems with our system is that families of color tend to not have the assets that they pass down from generation to generation. So, for example, when an elder in a black family dies, there may be a house, but chances are there's not a house to pass to the heirs. There's not much left in retirement accounts. The pension ends when the person dies, so there's no real wealth or savings to pass down to that person's heirs. In white families, I often see, you know, just even among my friends who are not wealthy people, but I often see among my friends when their grandparents or parents die, there is some money that's passed down. There's a home that can be sold. Sometimes there's two properties, a home and a vacation home, that can be sold and the proceeds passed down. Or there's a discussion among siblings, do we want to sell the vacation house that we, you know, that's not something that a lot of families of color have. You know, they just don't have those assets to support the younger generation. And that's a big part of what separates families of color from white families in our society. It's one of the big things that contributes to inequality, mm-hmm. racial inequality mm-hmm. in the United States. So I should point out too that any new taxes that are passed at the state level, again, would take at least 18 months, probably closer to 2 years, to implement and collect. So cuts in the state budget are going to be inevitable. Washington is not unique in the United States. Every state has been impacted by the pandemic recession, with many seeing shortfalls of between 10% to 20% of their budgets, and some of them higher than 20%. This is why so many states are jumping the gun to reopen, even when they have new COVID-19 cases still increasing in many states. Others, like our state, have seen the overall number of cases go down, but we have hotspots where case numbers are increasing, like parts of Eastern Washington, which saw a big spike in COVID-19 cases after the Memorial Day weekend. And that's a cautionary tale of what we might expect as we begin to move to phase two. Even here in King County, people, and there are a lot of people, just ordinary people, who don't understand the difference between, you know, the initial restrictions and phase two. So I'm seeing a lot of people on the streets who are gathering together, obviously not in the same family, who are walking close together without masks, people who are having parties with friends. You know, even in the building across the street from me, I saw a group of people together, obviously young people in their kitchen, you know. Mm-hmm. It was nighttime. They had their lights on and their windows wide open in their kitchen having a party, no masks, no social distancing, nothing. I see people in parks like mm-hmm. Seattle Center. Seattle Center, the city has posted big signs saying, you know, when you enter city property, you are required to wear a mask, cover up. People are not doing it. I see like maybe 20% compliance with masks in city parks. And yeah. Again, that's just putting us all at risk of a COVID-19 spike.
Yeah, just on my walk here today, I passed by a kids party, what appeared to be a kids party with
lots of little kids.
Lots of little kids just climbing all over each other, and the parents were standing next to each other observing that, as parents do when that mm-hmm. happens.
Talking,
and
yeah.
And I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
Sharing is caring.
Little hotbed of yeah. COVID-19 spread there. And, you know, there are people who believe that, gosh, we may just as well, because it's going to be a while before we get a vaccine, we may just as well all get it, have a mild case, and be done with it and have immunity. But there's two problems with that. One, we don't know how long immunity lasts after you've been sick. And two, you don't know if you or your child are going to get the serious, serious version of the virus. And I just want to talk about that for a minute. The World Health Organization had released a study this week where they looked at the number of people worldwide who have complications that could put them at risk at getting the severe version of the virus that sends you to the hospital and puts you on a ventilator. Okay, they tried to estimate the number of people worldwide, and they were only looking at health conditions. So they were not looking at other things that could put you at a risk of getting the severe form of the virus, like poverty, like food insecurity, like age. They didn't even really look at age. Mm-hmm. They were only looking at pre-existing health conditions. And the total number was 1 in 5 people worldwide, 1.7 billion to 2 billion people worldwide. People in the United States, if you look only, and they didn't consider one health issue because it's a lifestyle issue, not a health issue, which is obesity, which does put you at a much higher risk of having breathing complications and having to be treated in a hospital for severe side effects of COVID-19. They didn't include obesity. Here in the United States, nearly half of Americans
are obese.
Yeah. Nearly half of Americans are obese and or have other serious complications. So if you're young and you're healthy and you're thinking your kids are young and healthy and you're safe, you're fooling yourself because you don't really know. You don't really know. In addition, doctors have been looking at other things that could put people at higher risk. They're talking about blood type, because your blood type determines what kind of proteins are on the exterior of your cell that could allow COVID-19 to spread to be more severe in your body. And blood type A, I'm blood type A. Blood type A, it seems, puts you at higher risk. So we just don't know. There's so much we don't know about the virus and about why some people get sicker than others. Some very young, very healthy people have gotten extremely sick and died. And that includes children, particularly babies and young children. So if you're thinking, let's just do these, you know, pandemic parties where my kid gets sick, I get sick, we have a runny nose, and then we're fine in a week. You are kidding yourself. And you are practicing child abuse, I think. I really do believe that. And I need to point out, too, that a lot of people have gotten the illness and not had to go to the hospital, but have been sick for weeks with the virus. They've been sick for weeks, and they have had lingering complications that haven't sent them to the hospital. But I would not want to get this. You know, I mean, the risks that I take are calculated. I try to, like today, I'm probably going to shelter at home for a couple days. I'm probably not going to go anywhere on Sunday. I'm probably going to be extremely careful on Monday when I go back to work. Because I'm going to be careful over the next week. And I'm going to try to wear my mask all the time, indoors and out. Whether I'm going into the grocery store or whether I'm just walking down the street, I'm going to be wearing my mask because I could be a vector of the disease and I could spread it to other people. And people need to take that seriously. And they need to, if you don't have a mask, you need to get a couple, two or three or four. I have four, so that I can wash them regularly to keep my health in good shape, you know, because, you know, wearing a dirty mask is not good for you either. But people need to take it seriously. And I think this reopening early like this to save the economy is a huge mistake in terms of the impact on people's lives.
But I've found that if you wear a mask that's visibly dirty, people give you a much wider berth when you're walking down the street. Especially if there's like ketchup and stuff on it. They're just like, oh my God.
Okay, Mike.
Just a little tip.
So, anyway, there's a couple of other things that happened this week.
Yeah, we just got about 9 minutes left.
Yeah, I want to talk about two Supreme Court decisions this week. One is the DACA decision. The Supreme Court, four liberal justices, Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, plus John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice, decided that the Trump administration, when Donald Trump just unilaterally declared that he was ending the DACA program, that the Trump administration did not take the correct steps to end the program, that they did not provide an adequate reason or follow federal government procedures to do that. Now, back in 2012, Barack Obama broke an impasse over immigration reform in Congress, and he created by executive order the DACA program for young immigrants, people who were brought to the United States when they were children from a foreign country. He decided that if those immigrants registered with the federal government in the DACA program, that they would be allowed to stay in the United States and work until Congress passes comprehensive immigration reform. And Trump in 2017 just unilaterally announced that, you know, DACA's over. All those people who gave their personal information to the federal government to be part of the DACA program, you now can be targeted for deportation. And of course, immigrant rights groups and the ACLU sued the federal government, saying you can't just reverse an order like that. There have to be procedures. You have to give a good reason, you know, and you have to follow federal procedures to do that. And the Trump administration tried to defend it in court. And here we had a court dominated by conservative justices decide, no, the Trump administration's wrong. You do have to provide an adequate reason. You do have to follow government procedure. And Chief Justice Roberts wrote in the majority decision, he wrote, quote, "We do not decide whether DACA itself," I just added the DACA itself, "or its rescission are sound policies. We address only whether the agency complied with the procedural requirement that it provide a reasoned explanation for its actions. Here, the agency failed to consider the conspicuous issues of whether to retain forbearance and what, if anything, to do about the hardship to DACA recipients." So essentially, the court was saying, look, Donald Trump can't just by whim decide to end a program and to burden an estimated 650,000 people and deport them without providing good reason and without following federal procedure. That's essentially what the decision was. It made no decision on the legality of the DACA program or not, which is what the four conservative jurors discussed in their dissenting opinion, was that, you know, oh, DACA was illegal from the beginning, therefore we should just allow Donald Trump to break the law and end it without giving a reason and without following procedure. And John Roberts decided to join the four liberal justices and uphold legal procedure and uphold the requirement that federal agencies follow their own procedures and that the president give a reason for his decisions. So that is good news. I was greatly disappointed that there were not more conservative justices who joined that opinion. Now, the second Supreme Court opinion this week was an historic decision on LGBTQ rights. It was Justice Gorsuch and Justice Roberts joining the four liberal justices to support the right to work for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender employees. So it extended Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bars discrimination against employees based on, you know, race, et cetera, but also sex. And it said that term sex applies to sexual orientation and to gender identity. So that was pretty historic. And while that surprised a lot of people, I have to kind of step back for a second and say it really probably shouldn't have been a surprise. We probably should have considered it the minimum that we can expect in a capitalist society is that the Supreme Court would uphold the right to work for everyone, right? Because upholding the right to work for everyone, regardless of who they are and you know, how they self-identify, is it maintains a large enough employee pool that corporations can pull from in order to, and a large pool of the unemployed, a large enough pool so that corporations can hold down wages and hold down salaries. When the employee pool shrinks, then the power shifts to employees to demand higher wages. And so, of course, I think in a capitalist society that we have to look at it as the minimum that the Supreme Court could do to maintain the right to work. So I think that's really what underlies Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch's decision to join the four liberal justices. But and we see that with the very narrow nature of the decision. The decision was only on Title VII. It was not anything else to do with LGBTQ rights. And Justice Gorsuch, the conservative justice who wrote the majority opinion, he said, quote, "We do not purport to address bathrooms, locker rooms, or anything else of the kind," end quote. So it was very narrowly based on employment, the right to work, the right to employment. So while a lot of people were celebrating and were deeply surprised that Gorsuch joined the liberal, Gorsuch and Roberts joined the liberal justices, I was not as surprised because, you know, the right to work is a conservative mainstay. And usually it means the right for employers to bust unions. In this case, it also means anything that impacts the larger pool of employees that corporations can draw from. And the larger the pool, the more likely they are to be able to hold down wages and salaries.
So keeping indentured servitude safe.
Yes, supporting the right to join the workforce. I think that's a conservative mainstay, regardless of who you are.
So Supreme Court weighing in on doing their part to get the economy going again.
Yes, exactly.
Keep trotting out. All right.
So that's a little different take from the mainstream media's take on that decision.
Very good. Well, we are just about out of time, so we can hopefully expect more takes like that next week.
Yes, I plan to be back next week. We're going to try to get Jav in
pipe him in through the magic.
Pipe him in. I know he's been following the COVID-19. Yeah, he's been following the particulars of the COVID-19 crisis. He's also been following the particulars of police brutality stories all across the U.S. Mm-hmm. I'm not as focused on the individual events that are happening in different police departments and in different municipalities. I'm looking more here at our local scene and about the issues in particular. The economic impacts of racism are really kind of my specialty. Economic impacts in general.
All right. Well, looking forward to having you back next week.
Yes, I'm so glad to be here.
All right.